It's KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for joining us again today. You know who foretold the Seattle boom? My next guest did 15 years ago. He called it the rise of the creative class, an urban revival where knowledge workers and creative professionals would cluster in cities and build great things and solve problems and make those places vibrant and thriving. Richard Florida sold his influential vision to cities, including Seattle. Well, it didn't all work out quite like he thought it would. Richard Florida, welcome back to KUOW.
It's great to be with you.
Is Seattle a great example of what you meant when you described the coming urban renaissance?
Well, you know, that's a great question. Seattle featured heavily in my 2002 book, The Rise of the Creative Class. And I recall a passage I wrote about witnessing a group of rabble-rousers pounding pots and pans, walking through Belltown, I believe it was, saying, keep the construction and construction noise out. So even then, even though I don't think I could fully realize it, Seattle was a place that was at the absolute cutting edge of what later became the urban revival. And, you know, I think that I really could not predict. I think, you know, people ask if I'm sorry, do I feel I got anything wrong? I'm not particularly sorry. I think my new book is a logical extension of the old book. I don't think I got much wrong. I think, as you kindly said, I predicted that this knowledge group, this professional group, these artists, these call them the creative class, would come back to cities. I think I fully underpredicted how much of a tsunami wave this would be. And not across the whole country. Of course, it's great that Detroit has made a comeback in Pittsburgh, my home city at that time. But in the places that are the epicenters, the Bay Area, New York City, Boston, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, and your own Seattle, I could never have predicted what would happen.
Well, some people in Seattle have obviously thrived. It's worked out, except your new book is called The New Urban Crisis. So how have urban revivals not worked out like you thought?
Well, I think this book is the logical extension 15 years later of Rise of the Creative Class. And if Rise of the Creative Class was celebrating or detailing or outlying or identifying the green shoots of urban revival as cities like Seattle, quite at the cutting edge of this, you know, Amazon was already in the old hospital. South Lake Union was already starting to be built. So at the time, I used Seattle as an example of an urban tech. You know, the Silicon Valley was suburban tech companies. Seattle already was a pioneering example of urban tech. What I think happened in the intervening years, because my book, the data went up to 1999, it's really between the year 2000 and now that the urban revival, not only in Seattle, but across the country, really accelerates. And so what you had was a streaming in, not just of young people, but baby boomers, wealthy people, wealthy foreigners, tech companies, not just in Seattle, but, you know, New York is a big surprise to me that tech companies actually has a bigger venture capital-backed tech industry than does Seattle. So all of this came back to the city, increasing inequality, increasing the segregation of races and classes, making housing unaffordable. And I just want to add this, because of the Amazon thing, I actually looked this weekend at housing affordability in Seattle versus other places. And I was shocked to see, even someone who's supposedly in the know like me, that Seattle was, yes, it was more affordable than the Bay Area by probably half, but it was just as expensive, if not more expensive, at the metropolitan level than metropolitan Boston, metropolitan Washington, D.C., and metropolitan New York City. So you are really in the eyes of this storm of a new urban crisis of growing inequality, growing segmentation, and growing housing unaffordability.
And we know that so well here. It's very obvious. Rich apartments downtown, poverty moving to the suburbs, middle class disappearing. I want to know why. Why didn't our creative tide lift all boats?
Well, it didn't. I mean,
why didn't it?
It certainly didn't. I had seen this as early as 2003. I had written an essay in the Washington Monthly detailing that Seattle and Austin and San Francisco and New York are leading creative edge economies, were also our most unequal. But I don't think it fully dawned on any of us, including myself. I wrote that. I wrote the words. I have the essay. But the divisions, and when it really dawned on me, is not just when I looked at the numbers, they call them Gini coefficients. When I did a simple calculation, you know, you don't even know why you do these things. One day I said, let's look at the amount of money left over after paying for the housing that the knowledge worker has left over, the blue-collar working man has left over, and these service workers, you know, 50% of the Seattle workforce doing low-wage, low-paid routine service work, largely disproportionately women, disproportionately African-American, Hispanic, and Latino. And the numbers that came back just floored me. You know, the creative class had more than enough to afford that condo, but the blue-collar worker and the service worker had nothing, literally nothing left over. They were broke beyond belief. And I think that's when it slapped me in the face. And so we now have a situation where the same clustering of wealth, of technology, of arts and culture in our great cities that kind of fuels our urban revival is carving these terrible divides. Not just terrible divides in that they make us divide us between rich and poor, urbanite and suburbanite, which you aptly said. It creates this horrific backlash, you know, of populism that propelled Donald Trump to office in the United States. So I say in this book, this is not just a contradiction or crisis of urbanity. This is the central crisis of America and its capitalism at our time.
I'm talking with Richard Florida, now the author of The New Urban Crisis. You do have recommendations for cities like Seattle. What are those?
Well, I'll start with a recommendation for Amazon, since we're talking in Amazon's hometown. Amazon has long been a urban company. It's long been downtown in Seattle. It's gotten a lot of great things. It's, according to some, the largest company in the world. Many say one of the best. Its owner, Jeff Bezos, is a striking entrepreneur, and many would argue, along with your own Bill Gates, one of the two richest men in the world. It's just gone out with a bid for a headquarters, and asking dozens of communities around the country to give them financial and tax incentives. I think Amazon should rethink this. It should say to Seattle, and it should say to these communities around the country, we're in with building a more inclusive prosperity with you. We're going to make an Amazon pledge. And not just Amazon, other anchor institutions, the University of Washington, the great medical centers, which have all been part of this revival, the companies that, you know, that are down in the city in South Lake Union, the great real estate developers that are profiting. We brought an urban revival by working together, by working as anchor institutions, hand in glove with city and civic officials. Now we know we have to overcome the new urban crisis. We're going to make an Amazon pledge. And here's what the pledge should say. Instead of just paying our knowledge workers fantastically and giving them good salaries, we employ a lot of service workers, daycare workers, cafeteria workers, people who work to make those knowledge workers and creative class better. We're going to give them a living wage. We're going to give them career ladders. We're going to pay them like the middle class because we so depend on them. Well, our high-tech hotshots can afford housing downtown, but we're going to build workforce housing on our campus for you, the workers of this, and affordable housing in our communities. Places like Seattle need transit. We depend on transit. In contrast to other tech companies that are creating their own private shuttle buses, we're going to work with you and help pay for transit that connects our outlying suburbs to our city. What a model this would show of a great progressive company working with this great city and now taking this, you know, and I need to add this. Amazon is not just locating another headquarters. It has so many distribution facilities and logistics facilities and other offices and innovation centers. It could take that and make an example of how to build a great inclusive community alongside other anchors. That's the kind of gift that the success of Seattle and Amazon could give to itself and to other parts of the country and the parts of the world. And that's, I think, where we have to get to.
Well, Richard, if Amazon decides to pay more attention to its shareholders than to your vision, what about the public side of it? Do you think the Seattle city leaders, would you advise them, given the new urban crisis, would you advise Seattle leaders to not give Amazon subsidies and tax breaks? Or would you say, you know, despite the downsides, everybody wants an Amazon. They could leave, give them what they want.
I'm lucky enough at this stage of my life to be asked by cities to help advise them. I've said the same to every single city. Don't give them a dime. Amazon is coming to you because you have a great airport or great talent or a great downtown or walkability. They're going to gain so much for that location. Engage them as a partner in inclusion. Engage them as a partner in inclusive prosperity. Encourage them to work alongside building a more equitable city. And, you know, the benefits to Amazon's brand, you know, I hate to say this because I love these companies and I probably spend the largest share of my income on Amazon.com. But, you know, I was talking to a congressperson from the Silicon Valley who very much supports the tech companies and how much they do in create innovation. And he said to me, you know, Richard, the pitchforks are out. Wake up, folks. The pitchforks are out. People are mad. They're mad at being displaced from their homes. They're mad at the inequity of their city. They're mad in San Francisco. They're protesting, also to some degree in Seattle. They're mad about Airbnb. They're mad about Uber. They're mad. They think some of them think Amazon is a monopoly. I happen to like the company. But boy, oh boy, what good you could do for your brand by, instead of taking the tax break, using that money to help build a great city, to provide affordable housing, you could do good for yourself and your brand, your stock price in the long haul, and your reputation. You can do good for the city. So that's what I think we should do as a nation. And I think, unfortunately, you know, I guess I used to believe that our president or our national government would do this, you know, whether that was President Clinton or the other President Clinton that was supposed to win, or President Obama, all of whom I voted for. And now I realize that America really is a much redder and conservative nation, and the federal government isn't going to help our cities. So the same groups of people anchor institutions, hospitals, universities, medical centers, companies, chambers of commerce, local community groups, labor groups, community groups, neighborhood groups that rebuilt our cities have to also work to make them more inclusive. That's been a big one for me.
Richard, Florida, you've said that you underestimated how the spike in home prices in these creative edge economies, these new urban centers, that spike would more than cover the wealth. It hasn't trickled down as you had hoped. What did you get wrong? What did you not understand about the way capitalism is working today here?
Yeah, I don't think I said that. I think others have put those words in my mouth for me. I think anyone who's read Rise of the Creative Class clearly, I said that our economy was class divided, that the creative class was the ascendant class, the blue-collar working class was declining, and this 50% of service class was struggling. And I said in that, if our cities and creative class didn't wake up, I said this in the last chapter, it's called The Creative Class Must Grow Up, our country would become more divided, and it would be like we are living on two separate worlds. Now, I didn't think that would give us the backlash. I never could have anticipated the backlash would be so severe that it would give us the most dysfunctional president in human history, Donald Trump. But I saw it. And then in 2003, I'm just being candid with you, I wrote an essay for the Washington Monthly in which I showed very clearly that places like Seattle, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, New York were the most unequal metropolitan economies in our country. I think I've just become more and more outspoken about the distributional side of this. And I think they work hand in glove. You know, that's why I think this urban revival is the central contradiction of capitalism. The clustering of activities like Amazon and techies and innovation and economic assets in downtowns is what powers innovation and productivity and wealth in our country. And at the same time, if we don't make it work for us, if we don't have policies like a better minimum wage and more affordable housing and inclusiveness, we get a society that's terribly uneven and divided. So I think I've decided that my goal has to be to advocate for the distributional side and the inclusiveness side. You know, I spoke to 1,500 or 2,000 people who make up the International Economic Development Council. These are the economic developers that build Portland and Seattle and New York and Chicago and all the little towns in between. And we talked about this. We've probably paid too much attention to economic growth and not enough to inclusive economic development. And the one thing that really heartened me is the only applause lines I got were not about how to make more competitive and innovative cities, but how to make our communities, our cities and suburbs more inclusive, and how we all should do that together. So I'm heartened that this message, not only my own shift in emphasis, but this message is being picked up by our cities and communities around the country.
Finally, Richard, Florida, as you've watched these capitalist contradictions, how has all this changed you?
Well, I'm older. You know, I wrote Rise of the Creative Class when I was turning 40. I'm now turning 60. So maybe it makes you a little wiser. I also, because of my career pressure, have two very little young kids. I want a better world for them. And I think my big wake-up call, honestly, was in Toronto, the rise of Rob Ford, the first real populist, and then Donald Trump. And I think I'm really concerned for the future of my country. I think this divide in America, which really is a product of our spatial inequality, not economic inequality, the fact that we have thriving places like Seattle and the Bay Area and New York and the Boston-Washington corridor, and so many places in the middle that are falling apart, I think that's the one. And I am really worried about our nation. But, and I will say this, my cause for optimism lies in our cities. You know, you said a lot of interesting thing about Seattle. We have a higher minimum wage. We're talking about community inclusion. We're working on our transit. You could have added, we voted for Mrs. Clinton. We have a progressive politics. We want to be a sanctuary city. You could have added many other things. We're kind and inclusive with regard to gay people. Our people vote progressively. I think what gives me hope is that our cities are growing up. And, you know, maybe it's the case even that my own creative class is waking up. I know we're guilt-ridden. None of the creative class likes what's happened. And maybe we're having a wake-up. Maybe Trump was our wake-up call that says, you know, our federal government isn't going to solve our problems. Right here in Seattle, and in all of our towns and communities across the country, we're going to have to solve our own problems. And I think that's my little ray of hope, that this jolt we got because of the divide is going to cause us to work locally to build stronger, better, more sustainable, more prosperous and inclusive communities.
Richard Florida was author of The Creative Class. His latest book is called The New Urban Crisis: How Our Cities Are Increasing Inequality, Deepening Segregation, and Failing the Middle Class, and What We Can Do About It. Great to talk with you, Richard. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure being with you again.
So, Richard Florida bemoans what's happened to innovation cities like Seattle, and those same cities are where he places his hopes. Like he said, it's the contradictions of capitalism. Contradictions of capitalism could be a subtitle of a radio show that you hear weekday evenings at 6:30. Mm-hmm. We cover business and the economy on Marketplace every day with your host, Kai Ryssdal, who's sitting with me. Hiya, Kai.
Hi, Bill. So that's really good, actually, the contradictions of capitalism. I like that a lot.
Indeed. What brings you to Seattle? Good to see you again. We were co-workers once.
We were, yeah. Long, long ago. I'm going out to Microsoft this afternoon, having to sit down with Satya Nadella, and we're going to run that in about a week on our Corner Office CEO podcast and on the air. Interesting things they are doing out there at Microsoft, and it sort of plays into, in fact, it literally does play into what Richard Florida was talking about and some of the things that he mentioned. And it's, boy, there was a lot in that conversation, but I'll tell you what. Couple of things. What he is talking about here, when he got to that bit about Amazon and what it could do and how it should be making these investments in the towns that it is in, not going out and looking for tax breaks and investment, it's a conversation to be had about the role of government in this society and this economy, right? And that is what Satya Nadella is trying to do at Microsoft. There is an awareness now on the part of some people. I think you see it at Tim Cook at Apple as well. He was talking today in New York, Tim Cook was, about DACA and immigration. And Tim Cook said, listen, I think our immigration policy ought to be about monopolizing all the talent so we get all the good stuff, as opposed to shutting the door. So I think there's a conversation happening now at big, big companies, and probably at smaller ones as well, about the role of companies in this society, in this economy, and what they can do to relieve some of the really genuine and honest and true things that Richard Florida said, right? There are gross problems of inequality in a lot of these cities. There are gross problems of racial divides. There are problems along all of those lines. And as he said, and as we've seen, the federal government's not able to do anything about it. The federal government is simply not able to, for reasons of political polarization and all of those things that we all know too well. So what you see happening, and I've seen this in my reporting around the country as well, you see things happening at a local level, not just in major cities like Seattle, but we were up here 6 months ago doing an election piece on the other side of the mountains. And you see in the small towns out in the Yakima Valley how things are working out there, where towns are saying, listen, we want to do things. We want to make things happen. And that, I think, is going to be the driving economic and social force as some of these problems are not ignored but unable to be solved at the national level.
So is that realistic for him to call on companies like Amazon with shareholders to raise wages and pay for affordable housing and pay for transit?
That's a great question. I think that's one of the questions I'm going to put to Satya Nadella, right? Because Satya Nadella works and runs, and Tim Cook at Apple and, you know, Sergey Brin at Google, those guys all run and work in global companies. They want the best talent. They have to be able to get their people physically to work. You've heard, I'm sure, of the Google buses down in Silicon Valley, right? Mm-hmm. And how that's completely messing up transit and all kinds of things.
We deal with that here as well.
Okay. They need all the systems, the infrastructure, the economic basis of our lives to work. And if it doesn't, then what are they going to do? They're going to suffer. Their business is going to suffer, so they have to make those investments. And I think what you're seeing now is companies coming around to that.
That's happening? I don't know of Amazon chipping in for the Puget Sound.
And it's really interesting. I'm not sure it is happening yet. But Google is, you know, they're doing the buses and they're trying to fix something like that. And yes, Apple just spent $5 billion on its new, maybe it was $1 billion on its new headquarters. Lovely, though, I'm sure it is. You know, you could probably use more affordable housing in the Bay Area instead of that $1 billion. But if you can't get your people to work, and if your people don't want to live in town because they can't get to work, then you've got a corporate profit problem, and that's what's going to make them pay attention.
Well, we're building light rail across the region here, but maybe Amazon is there's a lot of reasons why they're diversifying. Congestion maybe, but also just eggs in different baskets besides Seattle.
Sure, I'll buy that. I mean, there's a case to be made that it's a giant publicity play as well, right? Because now everybody in the country knows that Amazon's looking for a second home.
Yep.
And they're getting all these bids with tax incentives and giveaways and all of those things that are going to come from the taxpayer. A taxpayer base, by the way, that is already feeling stressed. And so now what are we going to do about this?
Yeah, those cities don't seem to be listening to Richard Florida's advice. Don't give them a dime, what he said.
Well, that's the story with sports stadiums and everything.
Yeah. Another thing we're discussing here. So do you have any other takes on... So he's talking about the contradictions of capitalism, populism, backlash. He talked about the spatial inequality that worries him in America, thriving coast, suffering midsection. He's just one guy with his point of view. I wonder if you've covered other takes on these trends.
Sure, I'll tell you what. So we had a conversation with Glenn Kelman from Redfin, the real estate site, a number of months ago on Marketplace. And one of the things that Glenn has been saying—
A Seattle company for those who don't know.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yes. Is that what's happening now because you have this spatial inequality, because the cities on the coast are so crowded and doing so, you know, air quotes here, well, right, with the creative class, people making lots of money, who are more often than not of a liberal bent, that skews literally the political geography of the country. So that you have huge chunks along the coast, and you saw this in the analysis of the last election, right? Huge chunks along the coast that are blue, much of the interior of the country is red. What if you take, I don't know, say Amazon, and move them to Kansas? Mm-hmm. And people who go to work for Amazon, they move out there, and that literally changes the political map of this country, right? It makes Seattle a little more red, makes Kansas a little more blue, and it would be interesting to see what would happen.
Finally, Kai Ryssdal, what are you going to ask Satya Nadella? What are you curious about when it comes to Microsoft?
It is actually interesting. I think what they're doing, and hopefully nobody at Microsoft is listening right now.
Everybody at Microsoft is listening right now. They love us.
For my sake, I hope not. For your sake, I hope they are listening. Clearly, they're rebranding this company now, right? And they're rolling out Satya Nadella, a more quiet, contemplative leader than their most recent CEO, Steve Ballmer. They don't want to be, as they haven't been for a number of years because other companies have taken this over, right? They don't want to be public enemy number one in tech, right? For a long time, Microsoft was the monopoly. They were the bad guy. I want to know how he's going to, you know, he's doing well profit-wise, right? They've got a $20 billion cloud business, share price is up, and life is good on a profit basis. But what are they going to do reputationally? And then in a corporate sense, to make sure that they don't miss the next big thing. They missed mobile. What are you going to do to not miss the next big thing, whatever that is? And that's sort of the gist of the comments.
Marketplace host Kai Ryssdal is in town to talk to Satya Nadella. His big get is the fact that he was able to appear on KOW's The Record. And Kai, it's good to see you again. Thank you.
Good to see you too, Bob.
Marketplace on 6:30 weekday evenings here on KOW, and we'll be right back. KOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KOW. You see the needles on the streets, in parks, on sidewalks in King County right now, people are shooting heroin into their veins. Last year, more than 300 people in the county died from an opioid overdose. One way Seattle and King County hope to reduce overdose deaths is by potentially opening two supervised consumption sites where a person can come in and use heroin, meth, cocaine with medical professionals and counselors on hand. That idea looks to be going to a vote. King County residents might vote on an initiative to ban supervised consumption sites. My next guests have strong feelings about that initiative and their own connection to heroin use. Corey Durant opposes supervised consumption sites with the group Speak Out Seattle. Tarina James was addicted to heroin. She's now studying to become a chemical dependency counselor. Welcome to you both. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Corey, why do you oppose safe injection sites, so-called?
My opposition comes from being there for my brother for 26 years. 23 years, he lived on the streets of Seattle. 3 years in supportive housing, but he's the one that brought it to my attention, and he was strongly opposed to them. He was adamant they're not going to work. The support system isn't there for them. We don't have the treatment beds available. We don't have the vocational training set up. We don't have the housing ready for all of it.
Why do you think your brother started using, if I may ask?
Family events, the death of our parents.
Well, let me turn to Tarina here. Tarina, you have your own connection to heroin. You began to use, in fact, after a death in your family. How did that happen?
I was a 17-year-old single mother, and I basically was left at my place with my roommate's two children and my child. And I woke up that day with a bad feeling, tried to call my grandma a few times, come get my son so that I could take them home to their mother. And unfortunately, that accident happened. And after 5 minutes, I had just checked on my son. 5 minutes later, my girlfriend rang the doorbell and said, let's go to the store. And when I opened the door, I found my son in his playpen with his necklace that he has that my grandmother had given him was connected to the outer part of the playpen. But he was not, how can I say this? He didn't actually hang himself on accident. It was a tragic accident where another child tried to pull him up and wake him up with the necklace. There was probably a foot from his head to the back where he could have struggled out of it had he been awake. But unfortunately, like I say, he was asleep when this happened. So 5 minutes, actually 3 minutes it takes without oxygen for a baby to be brain dead.
And all of this was traumatic for you?
Yes, I didn't know death. It was 13 days after my 17th birthday. I was, you know, my only goal in life was to be a good mom. And I felt like I failed. And not knowing death, you know, I was scared. I was, they did an autopsy. I didn't understand why I couldn't open his mouth, why I couldn't, you know, take his hat off, why he didn't look the same. I didn't know. Just didn't understand. I was never prepared for that.
You became addicted to heroin, Tarina, and you have said that if these safe consumption, supervised consumption sites had existed when you were on heroin, you might have gotten help sooner. Why do you say that?
Because first off and foremost, I believe that everyone needs to understand that when you're an addict and you're addicted to heroin, my daughter used to say it all the time, Mom, just stop. Just stop. It doesn't work like that. You can't just stop. People need to have their dignity given back to them. We need to stop with the stigma of all of it and give them their dignity, you know, get them housing, get them resources to get to where they're at. And I agree, treatment beds need to be more ready available, housing needs to be more ready available. But if they have the safe consumption site to start at, that's a start. That's somewhere they can go where there's not going to be fear of being arrested, where they might, you know, put a needle in their arm and break the needle off in their arm or not inject it correctly, which would cause an abscess. Or, first and foremost, using dirty water because they're homeless and they're in the street. They need clean supplies.
So I hear both of you saying that addicts need treatment. And Corey, you're hearing a former addict say that a supervised consumption site would have helped her toward that treatment. Why oppose it?
such as with my brother, I can remember walking in with him and him begging for treatment just to be told, there's no beds available. There's nothing we can do to help you right now. And to see him walk out defeated of, I'm asking for it and there's nothing there. His only option, as he said many times, was to go to jail. But then there's no treatment there. Going into the hospital when he was had abscesses, his heart valves were infected, knee infection. He's given methadone in there. And the day you leave the hospital, the methadone stops. There's no follow-up. There's no, you can get into the methadone program, but it takes the intake, the follow-up, and all of it. But you're having an addict leave a hospital that's been 9 weeks on methadone.
Did your brother talk to you about this conversation we're having about whether a supervised consumption site condones or seems to condone drug use?
It's not that it condones it. It sends the wrong message of it's acceptable. And he never found it acceptable. He was never, how do I say it? It wasn't that he was ashamed that he was a heroin addict. He wasn't proud of it, but he was ashamed of the stigma attached to it.
And you're saying that's a healthy shame for some people?
For some. For some, it is. For some, the stigma does eventually push them to where they will go into treatment. For others, it doesn't. It won't do anything.
Tarina, do you acknowledge a danger that for some people, a site like this would make drug use seem more acceptable?
No, I don't. Because first and foremost, we have many safe consumption sites all over the city already. If you really think about it, we have apartments, we have cubby holes, we have stairwells, we have car garages. I mean, they're all over if you really think about it, but they're unsupervised.
But they're not places with the supervised imprimatur, the okay of
Correct.
The government.
I don't believe that having that okay is going to cause people to feel that using drugs is acceptable. Most people, from my perspective and from being out there and being with these people, most of us don't want to be on it. We want help. We want, you know, to get out. But you have those people that aren't ready. And safe consumption spaces, to me, are more a harm reduction approach, a way of meeting people where they're at and giving them the chance, the time, and the option to go ahead and get treatment if they want to begin to heal, if you might say.
Corey, what about giving people some time? What about the people who overdose and would die if they're alone, but not if they're with a medical staff?
It is happening, but you're also having the addicts that are dying because of long-term use and medical reasons, such as with my brother. He didn't overdose. It was kidney failure. You have addicts out on the street that are having limbs amputated. The safe injection sites aren't going to stop that. And we need to really get the education out there and more of the low-income barrier housing to where you have people there, and to get accountability with them to where you're in housing now. Now let's move you towards treatment. Let's move you towards being more stable and either on methadone or Suboxone and other, you know, vocational programs, instead of saying, well, it's okay when you're ready, you know, we'll be here. But until then, we're going to give you a place to go to.
You know, people might hear us as disagreeing. We're talking about an initiative that might get voted on. But I'm seeing both of you nodding in agreement. You are two people with compassion, two people who are carrying some pain.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I guess I just want to highlight that we're talking, that we're sharing more than we're disagreeing on.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I think what people need to realize is we need to step back and realize it's not just those that are homeless that are addicted. There's housewives, there's cashiers at the grocery store, there's nurses. It all can come back to either childhood trauma or pain pill addiction. And I think there needs to be more available for people, and especially the younger generation coming up. We need to give them more options other than a safe consumption site.
Tarina, opponents also say that supervised consumption sites draw drug dealers to the area and can ruin that neighborhood. Is that a legitimate downside?
Our intention is not to have, you know, a big sign on the building, I would say, that, you know, is announcing, hey, come use your drugs here. I mean, I think people are uneducated about what really a safe consumption space is. It's not, drug dealers are going to deal wherever they want to deal. It doesn't matter if you have a safe consumption space up, if you have a store, if you have a house, an apartment. It doesn't matter. They're going to do it where they want to do it. Do I think this is going to draw them there? No. I do have to say, though, one of the things about a safe consumption space that I, and it's not a disagreement, but I just want to make sure that everybody understands, I actually have a personal experience of almost losing a limb. I spent the last 2 years trying to save my arm. I have a scar from my finger knuckles to the back of my wrist, and it is full of cement because I had osteomyelitis and it ate the bones in my wrist, and they were about to amputate my arm. I wore a PICC line for 6 months. This started off as actually a spider bite, but because I was using heroin and I was living in the streets in a dirty area, I didn't always have, I didn't share as far as using other people's syringes, but I would let somebody use my cotton or my little tin that I cooked it in. And that's all it takes to spread that type of an infection. So by putting the heroin into my system, I continued to reinfect and reinfect and reinfect. And in fact, it got into my bones. And then I did get strep throat and I didn't have any symptoms, and that ate the bones in my neck. So as far as the safe consumption space goes, with that said, that is our biggest goal, is to have clean syringes, to have clean tins and cottons and, you know, alcohol swabs and everything that a person needs to mm-hmm. not spread disease, AIDS, Hep C,
yes,
osteomyelitis.
So finally, we're just about out of time for now, but Corey, you just heard a story of unsupervised drug use, and you said there's not enough treatment, not enough beds, not enough housing. But while all of that stuff could be improved, meanwhile, what's the alternative to unsupervised drug use? What's a better alternative if not supervised use with a staff?
Keep expanding the needle exchanges, the clean needles, the tins, all of that is available now. Let's expand it. Let's make it more available to the addicts. Let's also, you know, get more education out there. It's not just heroin. It's the pain pills. Let's get the education and get the younger kids to know this is what could be happening down the road.
And the childhood trauma, as you mentioned, as well. There are a lot
absolutely.
Of internal issues to deal with. Tarina James is a graduate of the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program that gives drug users access to treatment and support services instead of sending them through courts and jails. And she's studying to become a chemical dependency counselor now. And Corey Durant with Speak Out Seattle supports Initiative 27 that would ban safe consumption, so-called, or supervised consumption sites in King County, and it looks like Initiative 27 is headed for the February ballot. And I'm so grateful to both of you for telling your story and giving your perspectives on this. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
This is KUOW's The Record, and coming up, we're going to hear news from Canada with Vaughn Palmer, and you're going to meet the Seattle man who wore the swastika downtown this weekend and got knocked out. You've probably seen the video. You're going to hear from him in about 10 minutes. Please stay tuned. I would love to hear what you thought about our last conversation we just had about these potential government-approved, supervised drug use sites in King County. You just heard from two people brave enough to share their own personal stories. Will you send us an email to record@kuow.org? What is your experience with addiction? Tell us your story. record@kuow.org. We would love to hear from you. I'm Bill Radke. And I'm glad you've tuned in today. Hurricane Maria, as you've heard, is tearing through Puerto Rico now, and forecasters say it'll probably hit the Dominican Republic tomorrow, southern Bahamas on Friday. It gets harder to predict from there. We're still recovering from hurricanes Irma and Harvey. These rebuilding projects require lumber, and lumber's getting more expensive because of a trade dispute with Canada, where we find Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hiya, Vaughn.
Hello, Bill.
Will you remind us why we're fighting over wood?
Well, generally, through a lot of trade history between Canada and the United States, there's been an agreement to limit Canadian lumber coming into the United States, pushed by American lumber manufacturers. And usually we have a deal that says there'll be a quota or there'll be a tax or some limit. They were almost to a deal over the summer. They were looking at an agreement that basically said 30% would be a cap on Canada's share of the U.S. market. The Canadian government has come back and said, hang on, you folks are going to need one heck of a lot of lumber in Texas and in Florida. You'll be a major rebuilding job. The American lumber industry can't fulfill all of that. The American industry is, in fact, because of the quota, buying lumber. American home builders are buying lumber from Russia. They're buying it from Germany. So Canada is saying, why don't we come up with some kind of a workaround on this that would allow Canada to step in and fill the gap, provide more lumber, bring down housing prices in those areas where folks are going to have to be rebuilding, 100,000 homes damaged in Texas? The American industry has come back and said, you know, you crass Canadians, you're just trying to take advantage of our misfortune. I guess we are. But at the same time, I noticed that the U.S. Home Builders Association is saying, look, this is not a time to be having high lumber prices. This should be a time when we're stepping in to make it easier for people to rebuild their homes so they can get on with their lives. So that's where things stand. I don't know how it's going to come out, but Canada is, I guess, either being exploitive or being generous or both.
Yeah, someone at the Globe and Mail said these trade limits are like slapping a hefty tax on flood victims and sending the cash to U.S. mills and woodlot owners.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a lot of history in this argument, and you're never going to get the Canadian and the American industry or the Canadian and American governments to agree on this. But it does strike me that there is a case to be made here for a bit of a workaround on that quota. And if the United States industry is having trouble filling the lumber supply, particularly in those regions, there's a good argument, I think, to be made. Well, why don't you buy some extra lumber from Canada? When the demand is satisfied, they can go back to agreeing where the lid should be. It's not like this would be permanent for the next 10 years. It might just be a workaround for a few months.
And just in these 2 minutes, I wanted to hear about hockey, Vaughn, because Seattle's arguing right now over whether to subsidize a renovation of our key arena, or maybe a Soto Arena, to help attract pro hockey, maybe pro basketball. And I understand you have a disgruntled hockey club up there.
Yes, the city of Calgary is in the middle of an election to elect to re-elect their mayor, Mayor Nenshi. And the mayor came out and said, look, you know, the Calgary Flames are a great team here. They need a new arena, and the city is going to offer a package to assist them to get the new arena. The team and the National Hockey League both came out and said, no, there are no talks on this. It's not a good enough offer because essentially what Calgary is saying, we'll advance you some money to build a new arena, but you're going to have to pay it back. So it's a middle of an election there. I don't know if they're really serious about it. They might wait till the votes are counted on October the 16th. But there's been some speculation that if the team is still unhappy after the election is over, they might do what hockey teams and sports teams sometimes do, which is start shopping around for another location, like, say, Seattle.
Yeah, Seattle and Calgary, not so far away, but no chance of the Canucks getting pried out.
No, the Canucks are doing okay at the moment. They do have a fairly new arena already, although, you know, this thing goes on forever, eh? I mean, sports teams bargain very, very well with cities and get really good deals. And the one in Calgary, they're going to have to sort that out. The team says they're not using the election as leverage to move to Seattle. They think they'll work out a deal, but they just didn't want to let the mayor get away with saying he already had one when there's still stuff to be negotiated.
Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer, good to talk with you, Vaughn. Thank you.
Bye-bye, Bill.
And one more story for you on KUOW's The Record in just a moment. Okay, final story for you today. Yesterday on this program, we talked about the punch heard around Seattle. 30-second video of a man wearing a swastika armband downtown getting knocked cold. He didn't file a police report. The cops say he left the scene without giving his name. So you might be wondering, who was that guy wearing the armband? What was he thinking? Well, while we were talking about this story yesterday, during the show, we got a phone call from the guy who got punched. He wanted to explain himself. So we called him back. We invited him in. Yesterday, I talked with him about what happened. This man lives in Seattle. We're not using his name on air. He says he wants to stay anonymous because his landlord said she doesn't want Antifa showing up at her property. Here is some of what he had to say. Why did you put on the swastika?
Because I should be allowed to wear whatever I want to.
Are you saying the swastika, you're surprised?
Germany by how many thousands of years?
Yeah, but listen, I just interviewed an anti-fascist member who said he would have wanted to talk to you, but that he could understand somebody having a violent reaction to the swastika. Let's listen to it. You can hear his emotion.
All right, thank you.
Listen to this.
What that symbol means is lampshades made of human skin. It's jewelry made of human teeth. It's the industrial extermination of an entire group of people, of my family, of my friends, of people like me. That symbol, those words, that ideology is violence.
Can you understand seeing the swastika as an assault, as the threat of violence?
No, because words and imagery are not assault. Actions are assault. And if we start to believe that imagery is assault, then this is rapidly becoming a witch hunt. And now anything that possibly has a relationship to something that wasn't great can now be considered a symbol of hate and used to shut people up, which is me getting punched. That's exactly what that was designed to do.
Well, yes, the swastika is a very old, it's a simple pattern, and it's very old. But it's come to be widely associated with not just hate, but mass murder. And so you're choosing to put the swastika on your arm.
It like
comes across as an advocacy. But how else would you expect people to see it?
I don't know you. And I understand where you're coming from. It seems like a common sense issue. And your question's totally reasonable. I'm not trying to be unreasonable with you. But the hammer and sickle to me represents the deaths of over 100 million people. So as long as Antifa's going to use the hammer and sickle, I'm going to walk around with the swastika. Deal?
Well, you might wear a hammer and sickle and get punched by somebody whose family was killed by the Bolsheviks. I don't know. But as you know, neo-Nazis are much more of a present threat. They're literally on the march.
Agree.
Well, you may not see it as a threat.
No,
but neo-Nazis,
I don't agree in this sense. I'm sorry. Let me clarify what I mean when I say I don't agree. Antifa is blatantly anti-capitalist, and they couch that in being anti-fascist. And so they're trying to conflate free market activity with some form of imperialist. You know, they lump this imperialist, capitalist, fascist all into it, and it's not the same thing. And I don't think that's a fair characterization.
But you weren't wearing a fascist T-shirt. We're talking about a swastika.
What does a fascist T-shirt look like? I've never seen one.
What I'm asking is, you brought up a hammer and sickle. I'm just saying, can you understand why a swastika seems more of a present?
More people die. Why is it more present? We have people literally marching with hammers and sickles.
Listen, I'll answer. Because we see people with swastikas literally marching any day. Yeah, it happened last week, and it could happen next week. And you might agree with them, but President Trump sees a white supremacist rally that ends in death and says there's good and bad people
on
both sides.
There's violence on both sides.
Yes.
Nobody wants to talk about that.
But I'm making sure that we're not talking past each other, that
no,
we understand
that
why the reaction is different to a swastika.
See why it should be different.
Okay. What did you think would happen in the streets of Seattle? What did you want to happen?
I didn't have any clear expectation in mind. What I really wanted was to be able to go out, walk around for like, I don't know, 45 minutes, an hour, and come home without incident. That's what I ideally would have happen in a free world where everything you wear isn't constantly monitored by the citizens' anti-fascist brigade. That's something we should be able to do. And what bothers me is that, you know, quote, news outlets like CNN are trying to characterize, because this is what I'm talking about with the progression. They're now trying to characterize everybody who voted for President Trump as an implicit white nationalist. I think those were their exact words. So at some point, you know, if I walked around with a Make American Great a baseball cap on, I can be stabbed. That's happened to people. The left has made it so that there's no distinction between actual fascism and sort of a conservative point of view. And I think that's what's dangerous for society. And I think that that's what I was trying to demonstrate with my little escapade.
Well, thanks for coming in and telling your side of this story.
Thank you for having me and allowing me to do so.
Again, that was the swastika armband-wearing man who you may have seen getting punched and laid out at 3rd and Pine. And I mentioned in there that I spoke with the anti-fascist who was shot in the rally at the University of Washington as the right-wing figure Milo Yiannopoulos was speaking. I talked with Josh Dukes about that punch and about white supremacy in this country and the uses and abuses of violence and compassion. We had a good conversation that you can hear now because we are tweeting out a link to that conversation right now at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll be back at it tomorrow. I hope you can join us.